The world is supported by LegalZoom. We're halfway through the year, but it's never too late to get started on things you want to accomplish. LegalZoom can help you complete some of the things on your to-do list with their friends and family discount. For more information, visit LegalZoom.com.
A win for protesters, today on The World. I'm Carol Hills. Widespread protests in Russia followed the arrest of an investigative journalist there. Today, a stunning reversal. All charges were dropped.
Today is a big victory for human rights activists, for the civil society of Russia.
Also, the Vatican officially rejects transgender identity.
It says people who propagate that idea are seeking to annihilate the concept of nature.
Plus, Iranian Americans are on edge as tensions rise between Washington and Tehran.
War is not the solution. Democracy comes by, first of all, learning it, by implementing it correctly, and by having all these ingredients that freedom and democracy needs.
Those stories ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. The Russian investigative journalist whose arrest sparked outrage in Moscow this week is now free. Russian authorities today dropped drug dealing charges against Ivan Golunov. Yesterday, his editor told us Golunov had been framed.
We are 100% sure that it was absolutely made up case.
Today's reversal by the Russian government was completely unexpected, according to the BBC's Olga Ivshina.
I still can't believe it's happened, because in Russia, 25% of people who are currently in prison are there because of charges connected to drug cases. And once you got into that sort of story, usually there is no way out. But today, you know, it's something really unprecedented happened and charges were dropped. But usually that's not the case. So today is a big victory for human rights activists, for the civil society of Russia.
So now the police who arrested him will be investigated. Does that mean on some level Russian authorities are admitting the entire case against him was fabricated?
Well, it seems that at least they are admitting that there are some serious troubles, because not only the guys who arrested him will be investigated, the head of the Russian Interior Ministry sacked two high-ranked Russian general, Moscow generals, who have a relation to the case, and this is already something. And of course, you know, specialists, journalists, activists now say that it should be just the beginning, because they demand for the system to be reformed, they demand, you know, for this case to be investigated, because everyone in Russia knows that there are many, many, many similar cases, and their outcome was completely different.
Now, whenever anything big happens in Russia, everyone here in the West thinks, oh, Putin decided it. So how far up do you think the decision went to drop this case?
Well, there are a lot of speculations now, but, you know, since the Minister of Internal Affairs was announcing that the charges were dropped, it means that the decision went quite high up. And yesterday, Putin's spokesman, Dmitry Peskov, commented on the case, and he said that Russian president is aware and he's being constantly informed, and General Prosecutor of Russia is also constantly informed. So it means that we can't say that they were involved in making the decisions, but definitely they were at least aware of all the negotiations and all the decision-making process which was going on.
And similarly, what about the original decision to arrest him? How far up do you think that goes?
It's hard to say, but Ivan himself said that, you know, he thinks that the fact that it happened has correlation to one of his investigations. He released a really important investigation about funeral business in Moscow, and he managed to prove that some really high-ranking Moscow officials and some security officers have relation to this business and are probably involved into these huge sums of money floating around. And he was preparing the second part of this investigation, and he said he was receiving a number of threats. So, at least he thinks, and many of his friends and colleagues think, that people who have a relation to funeral business in Moscow were involved in and were interested in shutting Ivan up. And that might have been the beginning of this chain, which led up to his detention.
How different was the public reaction to Ivan's case compared to other similar instances?
Well, this time the support was really massive. But one of the reasons was that, you know, Ivan is a very modest guy. Secondly, many other journalists in Moscow knew him. So this provided the massive news coverage which was needed. But, you know, this all wouldn't be possible without huge, huge mass support, because there were rallies in his support, individual protests all over Russia, which means that many, many people who have no relation to journalism just felt, they felt insecure. They felt that this story might become their story if they keep silent. And fortunately, this time, the outcome is really positive.
The BBC's Olga Ivshina with the news that journalist Ivan Golunov is free in Russia today. Thanks so much, Olga.
My pleasure.
Another big story today, the Catholic Church officially took a stance on gender identity. The Vatican issued a document that rejects the notion of gender fluidity. It's titled Male and Female, He Created Them. And it's meant to provide guidance for Catholic educators as well as parents. I asked Josh McElwee with the National Catholic Reporter to tell us what's in the document.
It takes a really critical view towards the modern idea that gender identity might exist on a spectrum. It says people who propagate that idea are seeking to annihilate the concept of nature. It even questions the kind of the perspective or the intentions of transgender people, saying they're meaning to be provocative against traditional frameworks. It's quite blunt, quite critical, and quite interesting in this era of Pope Francis, who's much more known for a more dialogical viewpoint.
Speaking of Pope Francis, is this something he endorsed and signed on to?
No, it's quite interesting. The document is signed by the two Italians who lead this office at the Vatican, the Congregation for Catholic Education. Normally, a document of this type, which comes from a very high level at the Vatican, would at least towards the end mention that the Pope had been presented with the document and had an opportunity to comment or an opportunity to review. This document does not say that. I don't think it's possible the Pope didn't see the document, but it is possible that he wasn't quite in agreement or didn't think that he wanted his name in it.
Give us the backdrop for this. Why was this released now? It happens also to be Pride Month.
It's very unclear. The document itself is dated in February, so it's being released several months after it was signed and dated. I don't know that the Vatican would know enough to know that this is Pride Month and know that that's a fairly big deal. Obviously, this is something the Church has been thinking about. It's noticed that, especially in the Western world, there's a new way of thinking about gender identity. And the Pope himself has spoken about gender identity and the need to accompany people in their various walks of life. He said you can't judge whole classes of people all at once, that you need to look at individual cases. And so this document obviously does something quite different.
So Pope Francis has seemed to be more kind of open to different ways of assessing gender identity and sexuality.
Well, the Pope has been quite clear about Catholic teaching in this area, in that the Church believes that humans are born male and female. But the Pope has been open to the fact that, you know, people have different experiences. In 2016, the Pope even spoke about meeting with a Spanish transgender man at the Vatican and talking to that person, walking with them and understanding where they were coming from. Something that this document doesn't do. It doesn't mention any discussions with transgender or LGBT people. In fact, it only cites in its footnotes church teachings and former papal documents. So it doesn't appear that there was an effort to meet people where they are, to understand kind of what's going on in the hearts of people.
This report was issued and geared toward Catholic educators and Catholic educational institutions. Is it supposed to be used as a textbook, as a reference to answer questions? I mean, how is it supposed to be used?
I think it's a bit like a series of guidelines or a way to have a discussion. It's a bit unclear how it will be used from here, how that dialogue could go forward when the Vatican has used these very critical terms of the people it's trying to dialogue with.
Josh McElwee is the Vatican correspondent for the National Catholic Reporter. He's been speaking to us from Rome. Thanks a lot, Josh.
Yeah, thank you.
Earlier, we also reached out to Marianne Duddy Burke. She's with Dignity USA, a Catholic organization that focuses on LGBT rights.
It is kind of insulting and hurtful that as so many people around the world are reflecting on the importance of the Stonewall rebellions 50 years ago and how much progress has been made in many places in the struggle for LGBTQI equality, that this comes down and really tries to shut all of that down.
I know you've said you're worried about the impact globally of a document like this. What might that impact be?
I think that in places like many countries in Latin South America, in some places in the Caribbean, in African countries, in places where Catholicism is really embedded in the culture of those nations or even in the legal structures, that this could lead to more repression of students and of young people who are coming to terms with their identity. You know, we know that that is harmful to people physically, psychologically, spiritually, emotionally. It just does so much damage. And I think that it is our responsibility as Catholics to bring that experience and that knowledge to these officials.
The Catholic Church issues statements and documents on a whole host of subjects. In this day and age, does anybody really pay attention?
You know, the Vatican runs the largest educational system in the world, the largest networks of hospitals, the largest social service network in the world. So what comes out of the Vatican in terms of policy really does impact the lives of almost everybody on earth.
Marianne Duddy Burke with Dignity USA. Thanks a lot, Marianne.
Thanks for your time.
Tensions are still sky high in Sudan, where a brutal crackdown on protesters staging a sit-in last week left as many as 100 people dead. Pro-democracy activists in Sudan are still struggling to regroup. And heavily armed men from a government militia known as the Rapid Support Forces and made up of former Janjaweed fighters still occupy much of the capital. Financial Times reporter Tom Wilson is in Khartoum.
Those armed men can still be seen on most corners throughout the center of the city, you know, sitting in the shade with their military trucks, high caliber machine guns and rocket propelled grenades. And that is creating a very tense atmosphere.
Wilson recently interviewed a young Sudanese surgeon who treated victims of the crackdown on the protesters' sit-in.
The scenes that he saw, he said they would never leave him. He saw armed men throwing dead protesters off a bridge into the River Nile. He then went into one of the hospitals next to the city and was followed in by soldiers who he told me fired live weapons into the emergency room waiting area.
Other testimonies from the attack are still trickling out, including accounts from Sudanese who say paramilitary forces raped dozens of activists during the raid on the sit-in. Dalia Abdelmonim is an activist in Khartoum.
It was rape of both men and women. And since Sunday, we've been hearing about these numbers, and some even said the numbers are more because a lot of people don't report the rape, unfortunately. So it's not surprising because rape has always been a tactic of the Janjaweed. They used it in the West during the conflict in Darfur, and there's no reason why they wouldn't transport that same tactic down to Khartoum. I mean, end of the day, their policy is kill or be killed, and rape is one of their weapons.
Abdelmonim says the numbers of rapes may never likely be known. Still, she says these atrocities will not deter those opposed to the transitional military council that is now in charge in Sudan.
At this moment in time, all we have is the power that we have as people by striking, by going in civil disobedience, by not helping the TMC stake its claim even further as the rightful or the current leaders of Sudan, because they are not. They weren't put there by the people. They weren't chosen by the people. They supplanted themselves to be the leaders. And this is us telling them, no, you are not. And we will not accept a military government as our leaders. We've had them for the past 30 years. We know what they're like. We've seen what they've done, and we've seen what they're still doing to us at this moment in time.
Opposition activists declared an end to their general strike today. Abdelmonim says though Sudanese may return to work in the short term, they'll continue to devise ways to pressure the military to step down from power. You're tuned to The World. I'm Carol Hills with The World. Over the past few weeks, we've been taking a look back at 2015 and the events leading to the U.S. and other world powers striking a nuclear deal with Iran. And we're doing it with help from Lacey Healy, host of the PRX podcast, Things That Go Boom.
Hi, Carol. So, yeah, as you recall, the Iran deal was really contentious. There were a lot of folks on both sides for and against the deal, and there were a lot of organizations working behind the scenes. So this week on Things That Go Boom, We're looking into one of those organizations, and we're following the money to figure out who's behind it and the role that money had to play.
So what's the organization?
So it's called United Against a Nuclear Iran. It goes by the acronym UANI.
UANI.
I don't think they really thought about the acronym before they made the name. So UANI was founded before there was even a deal on the table back in 2008. Their stated objective was, and is because they're still around, it's, quote, to prevent Iran from fulfilling its ambition to become a regional superpower possessing nuclear weapons. And during the negotiations, they were out there. They were working to sway public opinion along those lines. And they even helped write legislation. So to help us in our research, we reached out to Catherine Sullivan from the podcast Trump, Inc.
Hi, Catherine.
Hi, Lacey.
Catherine noticed that UANI has some big names on the roster, folks like Jeb Bush and Joe Lieberman, along with a whole slew of folks from the intelligence community. But there's another reason that UANI sparked her interest.
It was also unclear where their money came from, and they had a reputation of being quite secretive.
There's this clip of UANI's co-founder Mark Wallace in 2012, where he's asked twice, who funds UANI?
Now, this is a lobbying group. Who is funding this?
Well, first of all, lobbying group, I think, is misplaced. It's really an activist group. We have over 27...
And twice, he dodges the question.
A government funded?
It's not. We're privately funded. It's a 501c3 not-for-profit. Our contributions are confidential because a lot of people who support this, we don't want to be...
I don't think many respectable organizations that don't have anything to hide would not disclose their funders.
Catherine learns that there's this one reporter who's been bird-dogging the story of UANI's funding for years.
My name is Eli Clifton. I'm an investigative reporter who focuses on the role of money in influencing U.S. foreign policy.
And UANI is on his radar.
It's really a fantastic case study and maybe a microcosm of the ways in which American foreign policy is actually influenced and implemented.
You might remember, the Obama administration had been using tough sanctions to bring Iran to the negotiating table. But UANI is going the extra mile, attacking even the folks that are doing legal business with Iran, like companies selling medicine and vaccines.
This was no longer a coercive strategy to bring Iran to the negotiating table. Instead, it was clear that they wanted something else.
Eli wants to know what. So he starts digging around, and at first, he doesn't turn up much. But he keeps looking at UANI's roster of big names. All these former diplomats and politicians.
There was little to no explanation for why this startup organization with a rather narrow focus would have that draw to it. It didn't make sense.
And he notices something kind of odd. Remember Mark Wallace, UANI's co-founder? When Eli looks into it, he realizes that some years, he's not even getting paid by UANI. His actual salary traces back to this guy named Thomas Kaplan.
Well, Mark Wallace is leading one of the country's loudest pressure groups on Iran. He's also working as a top executive for Thomas Kaplan at his company called the Electrum Group.
So that's interesting. So who is Kaplan then?
So Thomas Kaplan is a gold and silver investor. He's a billionaire. He speaks with a very particular type of affect, with a kind of indistinguishable accent.
Gold is not a commodity. It is a currency with the longest known provenance that we have. Actually, gold and...
Thomas Kaplan clearly puts a lot of effort into cultivating a certain image around himself as a Renaissance man.
He has a PhD from Oxford in British colonial history, and he also has some pretty major hobbies.
He started a big cat conservation organization called Panthera. Oh, and he's one of, if not the world's largest collector of Rembrandts.
Eli's pretty confused by the whole Kaplan connection at first, but then something happens that helps him connect the dots.
Well, I won't say how I found it, but what I did find, or what I did get, is something called United Against Nuclear Iran's Schedule B form.
And it's the part of a nonprofit's tax form that tells you where their money comes from.
Eli had a snapshot of UANI's funding from 2013. The first name is Sheldon Adelson. He was one of Trump's top campaign donors, not so big on Iran. In 2013, Adelson gave UANI $500,000.
I mean, Sheldon Adelson's pretty extreme. He has, like, publicly said that we should bomb Iran.
So check mark in that box. That was no surprise.
There were two trusts listed on the form. One is called Butterfield Trust. The other one is called New Generations Trust. Mm-hmm. But when you look in the address section of what these trusts are, it says care of the Tigris Group.
What is that?
The Tigris Group is a financial firm that's controlled by Thomas Kaplan.
So together, Eli Schedule B says that these two trusts controlled by Kaplan gave a total of $843,000 to Ioanni, which might not seem like much, but it's about half of Ioanni's total budget for the year. And that's not counting Wallace's salary.
So what you're saying is that in 2013, basically two people funded this organization.
Right. Most of their budget came from the Adelson Foundation and from Thomas Kaplan's trusts.
And significantly more from Kaplan.
Yeah, over $300,000 more.
You could buy part of a Rembrandt for that.
Yeah, just a small fraction.
About 3%. So after he finds a Schedule B, Eli has more questions than answers. Why is a gold and silver investor interested in naming and shaming groups doing business with Iran anyway? The simple answer could be that he's just ideologically committed to Ioanni's mission. But there's also this other thing, which is that the Iranians have, on occasion, used gold to get around sanctions because they've been shut out of international banks. There are even some reports of Iran stockpiling gold to shore up its currency, which could drive up the price of gold, meaning sanctions could be good for Kaplan's bottom line. To add fuel to the fire, an official filing for one of Kaplan's companies, a silver mine, acknowledges that political unrest in the Middle East is a factor in the mine's success.
Wow, that's quite the contention. Lacey Healy, what does Kaplan have to say about that?
He actually has declined to comment. We reached out through multiple avenues, called, emailed. We finally did get a hold of him, and he had no comment. Ioanni was the same. But we did talk to Ioanni co-founder, former ambassador Dennis Ross, and he told us that he thinks the claim that Ioanni might have something to gain or Kaplan might have something to gain from continued unrest in the Middle East is bunk.
I mean, that strikes me as being a leap. This is not an organization that is trying to promote unrest in the Middle East by countering the Iranians from having a nuclear weapon. They're actually trying to make things more stable. But they're not creating unrest in the Middle East. The unrest in the Middle East is endemic to the region.
Dennis Ross there. And Lacey, you said that Ioanni is still around.
Yeah, they are. So they're still naming and shaming companies. They're still advocating for greater pressure on Iran. But they're no longer being sued by a Greek shipping magnate.
A Greek shipping magnate. That sounds cool. But for that story, you and I will have to check out the Things That Go Boom podcast hosted by Lacey Healy. There's a link at theworld.org. Thanks, Lacey.
Thanks so much, Carol. Always a pleasure.
You're with The World. I'm Carol Hills. North Korea's system of social control reaches directly into people's homes.
Being submissive to a leader who is allowed to enter the apartments, who is allowed to check who is visiting them, what you say, which persons you meet, when do you leave in the morning. Yes, this is total control.
That story, ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. President Trump received another letter from North Korean leader Kim Jong-un today. He called it beautiful. Trump has received a half a dozen or so love letters, as he calls them, from Kim. But nothing has really changed in the year since the two met face-to-face for the first time at a summit in Singapore. The U.S. still wants North Korea to denuclearize, and North Korea still wants the U.S. to end sanctions. But what the two leaders haven't talked about are the appalling human rights abuses in North Korea. The Transitional Justice Working Group in South Korea released a new report that says it's identified hundreds of public execution sites in North Korea. Charles Van Denkowski is one of the group's advisors in Germany. He studies the Ministry of State Security in North Korea, also known as the secret police. He says they're the ones who carry out these public executions as part of a powerful form of social control over the North Korean people.
The form of social control by the Ministry of the State Security on behalf of the family Kim has two main goals: disciplining the Communist Party that it stays under the rule and follows the Kims, and the population. In North Korea, we have a very, very strong system of formal social control. It starts that you live in a household that is attached to 30 to 40 other households which are supervised by a leader, a household leader who has a key for your apartment and who is allowed to enter your apartment. Imagine 30 to 40 houses in Columbus, Ohio, where my family lives, being submissive to a leader who is allowed to enter the apartments, who is allowed to check who is visiting them, and who talks to the Ministry of State Security and the police of North Korea about what you say, which persons you meet, when do you leave in the morning or something.
This is the Ministry of State Security you're talking about. I mean, what does it do exactly on a daily basis? What are the people who work at Ministry of State Security doing?
We have analysts, the intelligence analysts, who analyze all inflowing reports. We have investigators who investigate political crimes. And we have the camp system, the very, very sad camp system of political prison camps, in which currently 50,000 to 120,000 persons of all ages and sexes are detained, including children. This is not because they were on trial. This is because their parents were on trial. And due to the principle of guilt by association, in some cases of severe political crimes, the older generation and the younger generation of a family is incarcerated together with the offenders. It's inhumane.
Is there any evidence that the various overtures between President Trump and Kim Jong-un, that when they're getting along or after the last year's summit, is there any indication that human rights abuses go down or that North Korean authorities ease up on its population?
I would hope that the President of the United States of America would have an effect on the human rights situation. I pray for that. This would be very great. But the form of social control and the dire human rights situation is one of the cornerstones of the influence on the power of the Kims. If the Kims close the camps, the Kims abandon the cornerstone of the deterrence of the system, and some people will start to criticize the dire food situation, the nutrition situation, the one-party system. So they have to rely on that system, because people will unrest and people will express their anger. If you abandon this total control system, the people will uprise because they have information from outside. They know how the world outside looks by DVDs smuggled into North Korea.
Charles von Dankowski is an advisor to the Transitional Justice Working Group. That group just released a new report that's found hundreds of public execution sites in North Korea. Charles, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
The Dutch city of Amsterdam has a problem. Too many tourists. 19 million of them last year in a city with a population of less than 1 million. Which is why Amsterdam is now one of several European cities looking to reduce the number of visitors. But the city has another problem. Its famously relaxed approach to the sex industry also attracts too many of the wrong type of tourists. The World's Orla Berry has our story.
Bert Knapp has lived in Amsterdam for 40 years. His apartment is a stone's throw away from the city's famous red light district and all its tourists.
Mostly these people come in the afternoon, start drinking, and as soon as they are happily drunk, they start puking in our potted plants and screaming.
The Dutch capital is a big draw for bachelor parties because of its tolerant attitude to sex and drugs. Tours of the red light district run throughout the day.
Entered our brothel area, and brothels going all the way through around the corner.
This is Martin, a local tour guide.
This is the oldest building of Amsterdam. We started at Dam Square, then the oldest street, oldest area, oldest building, oldest profession. Yeah, it is what it is.
He tells us about the history of the red light district, here known as De Wallen, and warns us how to behave.
Do not take pictures of the sex workers. Right? It's impolite to take a picture of somebody you don't know in general. They throw water at people that make pictures, so you're warned.
The women in the windows certainly don't appear too happy to see us. And this is one of the reasons the city of Amsterdam is putting an end to tours of the red light district starting from next year.
For the sex workers, it's a problem that these groups are staring at them and taking pictures.
This is Masha Tembruchekata with the city council. And it's not just the sex workers the council is worried about.
The people living in the area were complaining about, well, these huge groups in front of their doors that are really blocking the way, and the noise, because they have to listen to this story about the history of Amsterdam every 10 minutes.
There's also the broader philosophical question about how such measures might change a place that's long been celebrated for its tolerant attitudes. It's an issue the city genuinely struggles with.
We can hardly forbid things, but a lot of people wouldn't dress as a penis at home, so then don't be dressed as a penis here.
And she means that literally, not just figuratively. People do dress that way on the streets of Amsterdam. Some locals, though, are not happy with the city's plans.
I am Thalia from Amsterdam, and I work in a strip club in the Red Light District.
Thalia, that's not her real name, is also a spokesperson for the Dutch Union for Sex Workers. She's unhappy with the upcoming ban on tours of the Red Light District.
And I think with this point of view, they're killing the soul of Amsterdam. And I know a lot of women that work behind the window. To say it in a polite way, they actually don't really mind. I don't think they're really like thinking about this subject. I think it's on their mind to make money.
Thalia says women like her are dependent on tourists to make a living.
90% of the people that I work with are tourists.
There's also the concern about human trafficking and whether the women working in Amsterdam's Red Light District are there of their own volition. Thalia tells me she enjoys the work she does and that she grew up among sex workers. Someone else who's annoyed at the upcoming ban is LR Tiso van Patouw. He's the founder of the Amsterdam Red Light District Tour.
We want to tell people more about legal prostitution, about the people who live here, what you can find in the Red Light District.
Ellard's office is right in the centre of the Red Light District, just next to the world's first condom shop. Outside the window, we can see hordes of tourists filing by. I ask him if he would live here.
No.
Why not?
It's fun to work here. It's fun to have my office here. I hear the people walking on the streets and sometimes having a laugh, sometimes screaming. But yeah, sometimes it's so alive that when I'm looking for some quietness, it's difficult to find in the Red Light District.
Back on the tour, we hear about Amsterdam's famous coffee shops and the many legal highs on offer. As the tour comes to an end at the city's oldest gay bar, I ask some of the group for their reaction.
I think it's great.
And when they say they're going to ban these tours from next year, what's your reaction to that?
I don't think they should. I think it's really educational and it gives you a different perspective, right? And if you just walk through by yourself.
It was great. I learned a lot. It was excellent.
Do you feel there's too many tourists here?
I mean, I've been in New York City. There's way more tourists there and they cope quite well. So.
But unlike New York, Amsterdam is a low-rise city where residents live right next to some of its busiest tourist attractions. Long-term resident Bert Knapp has a message for future visitors thinking about coming to his city.
It's not a playground for grown-ups. Please, tourist, you're welcome, but understand that people live in these houses that you're walking by, so when you're screaming at night, I wake up.
And after the Red Light District tours are cancelled, maybe, just maybe, Bert will get a good night's sleep. For The World, I'm Orla Barry, Amsterdam.
There was a landmark gay rights ruling in Botswana today. The High Court there reversed a colonial-era law that criminalized same-sex relations. The punishment was prison for up to 7 years. Homosexuality had been illegal in Botswana since the late 1800s when it was under British rule. And overall, we should mention that more than 30 countries on the continent of Africa have laws that outlaw gay sex. As of today, that no longer includes Botswana, following a unanimous decision by the 3-judge panel, which sparked celebration outside the courtroom in the capital, Gaborone. Brilliant Cody is a gay rights activist in Botswana, and he was at the court during the ruling.
We went in silently because we were like mostly just confused, wondering what the ruling is going to be, or we're just going through mixed emotions. I mean, it's just been a long journey, honestly. We walked in, it was such a long session. I think for about 3 hours we're in there as the judge was reading the judgment. And finally at the end, when he just said it out, announcing that indeed same-sex conduct was decriminalized, we were just shocked, excited. We're hugging one another, we're screaming. It was just a very exciting, joyful thing to witness.
Were there a lot of people in the courtroom?
The court was packed. I mean, it was initially meant to be in one courtroom. They ended up having to open the partition in between just so they could also get extra seating on the other courtroom. So, I mean, you can just imagine how many people were there altogether.
It's interesting. The judge was quite definitive in his judgment. He said human dignity is harmed when minority groups are marginalized. He labeled laws banning gay sex as discriminatory, and he said sexual orientation is not a fashion statement. It's an important attribute of one's personality. What was it like to hear that?
For me to hear such words being uttered, it made me feel so valued. It felt as if I just bumped into my first love and they just confessed that love to me. You know, like that moment where you feel so special, that moment where you all of a sudden realize that they do mean it when they say they are fighting for equality. They want to see equality. They want to see all these aspects do happen.
Now, tell me about this law that has just been dropped. It's a colonial era law. And what did it say exactly?
So in this case, the Constitution wasn't really against same-sex people being in a relationship. But what they were being against was those people being in a relationship and having sex.
When you look at the continent of Africa as a whole, how big of a deal is this?
It's such a great deal. I don't want to lie. It feels good to be amongst the countries that actually do acknowledge as homosexuals and do acknowledge that indeed homosexuals want to partake in sexual conduct. So it is a great deal.
In the neighboring countries around Botswana, where are they on this issue?
I know Angola, Botswana, South Africa, and Mozambique. They are the countries that actually have decriminalized same-sex conduct. And then take a country like Namibia, where the law actually says nothing. But at the end of the day, what I think I can pick up from it is like just how liberal they are. That's the one thing that would make me want to visit them, regardless of me not knowing where they stand.
I'm curious, in Botswana, has the activism around repealing that law, has it been mostly gay men or also gay women?
It has been gay men and gay women, rather lesbians. So it's just been the whole community, I must say. Even the transgender society has been supportive of this, because what we really do understand is that this is all our battles. When we win these battles together, it will enable us to set all of ourselves free.
Brilliant. This court ruling comes in June, a month that celebrates gay pride. Do you plan any celebration?
Well, I was hoping that there would be celebrations, but I am probably hoping to pop a bottle with friends maybe later on this week.
Brilliant. Cody is a gay rights activist in Botswana. Thanks, Brilliant.
Thank you.
We heard earlier about the events leading up to the Iran nuclear deal in 2015. As you know, President Trump pulled the U.S. out of the agreement, and tensions with Iran have been rising ever since. They went up even further recently after a U.S. aircraft carrier was deployed to counter an unspecified threat from the country, all of which has put many Iranian Americans on edge. Today, we take you to the epicenter of the Iranian American community in the U.S., California, to find out how people there are reflecting on the recent tensions between Iran and the U.S. We start off with a story of one woman who was forced into exile. Here's the world's Shirin Jafari.
For more than 40 years, Homa Sarshar has kept a handful of documents inside a safe in her home.
It's amazing. They're all in really great condition.
Well, they have been in the safe since day one.
Club membership cards, bank records, old passports. But there's one document that's familiar to nearly all Iranians. It's a blue airline ticket that has the iconic logo of Iran's national airline, the mythical bird of happiness.
This ticket is useless, but it has some emotional or some nostalgic connotation with it, so it's like a part of my past.
The ticket is from Tehran. The stamp on it reads 1979. She was 35 at the time. That fateful year brought with it the Islamic Revolution, the event that forever changed Iran and the whole region.
It just put a big, painful wound in our psyche.
For Sarshar, 1979 was the beginning of her life in exile, something that she never expected. The ticket she shows me brought her and many thousands of others all the way to Los Angeles.
Okay, so I am standing at the
intersection of Wilkins Ave and Westwood Boulevard. And on both sides, you can see all Iranian, Persian restaurants, cafes, galleries.
Los Angeles is sometimes referred to as Tehrangeles. Across California, there are about 180,000 Iranians, according to the U.S. Census. Why California? I asked Persis Karim, director of the Center for Iranian Diaspora Studies at San Francisco State University.
Iran sent many students abroad in the 60s and 70s, and California was sort of the epicenter because we had the Higher Education Act, which made college education much more affordable at that time, including for foreign students.
She says California's mild weather appealed to Iranians too. LA's Iranian community is diverse. There are Muslims, Christians, Baha'is, Zoroastrians. Homa Sarshar grew up in a Jewish family in Iran. Now she hosts a popular Persian language radio show. It covers anything from where to get concert tickets in LA to what's going on with the sanctions back home. Lately, one major topic of conversation on her show is the possibility of a U.S.-Iran conflict. Iranians have heard it all before. There was George W. Bush, who labeled Iran as part of the axis of evil. John McCain joked with a supporter about bombing Iran.
Well, it's kind of like having a roller coaster ride. Every time that a new president comes and just gives promises, and we think that, oh, this time it's going to happen.
Sarshar is no supporter of Iran's current leaders. She's not forgotten how she was fired from her job in Tehran in the days leading up to the Islamic Revolution.
I find out that they fired all the minorities, including Jewish people, Assyrians, Armenians, and Baha'is, and they fired everybody.
But her disapproval doesn't extend to supporting a U.S. military action.
War is not the solution. Democracy comes by, first of all, learning it, by implementing it correctly, and by having all these ingredients that freedom and democracy needs.
All that, she says, must come from within the country, not imposed by the U.S.
670
AM. Here's the radio station that broadcasts Sarshar's show, KIRN 670. There are a dozen of other shows like hers, running throughout the day and night.
How are you doing?
Good, what's up?
Ali Reza Hikmatchoar is the program director. In his red fedora, red scarf, and red shoes, he gives me a breakdown of the Iranian-American communities in the area.
So, we do have different area in Los Angeles, or greater LA, you know.
He says opinions vary within these communities. Some Iranians support the regime. Others want the government gone, but no intervention from the U.S. But there's a group with a more hawkish view.
I was talking to two most famous singers in the United States and artists. The most famous names.
Iranians.
You cannot even imagine. Both believes that it's better this attack has happened, because after that, at least something good is going to happen to Iran.
These famous singers supposedly both support a U.S. military strike against Iran. In their view, that will lead to the country breaking apart and the end of the current Islamic establishment.
I have been talking to people. I asked them, if there is a war, would you fight for the United States or would you fight for Iran?
Homa Sarshar, the radio host again.
And they are not ashamed to say that they will fight for the United States to destroy Iran, because they want this regime to go.
For her, though, war is never a good option. She made that clear to Mike Pompeo 2 years ago, before he became Secretary of State. They met at an Iranian-American event in L.A. Sarshar adjusts the plane ticket on the coffee table. Her eyes well up.
This is the return.
This part of the ticket is the return leg of the flight she booked in 1979, which would have taken her back to Tehran. At the time, she thought she would be able to go back in a few months. But as the Islamic Revolution took hold, it was clear she couldn't. Yet, she's held on to the ticket, like a relic that belongs to a lost loved one.
For The World, Shirin Jafari, Los Angeles.
Tomorrow, Shirin heads to another part of California. This time she's in San Francisco, talking to a different group of Iranian Americans.
We're in the Juje class, the little chicks class, and we have...
We'll hear from one father who's grappling with how to discuss identity and geopolitics with his four-year-old son.
There's a deeper connection with Iran, no doubt. And we also love the U.S. culture. So what ideally is to be in an environment where he is nurturing his roots, but then he's also tapping into all the wonderful things that this country has to offer.
That story tomorrow, right here on The World. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. Thanks for tuning in.
PRI, Public Radio International.